Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. Thank you for listening. We would like to remind you that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Known as just a silly boy with a feely heart. Please consider supporting the show. Check us out on Patreon or simply leave a review on iTunes. Here's your host and creator of the show, Known Wells.
Hello, feely humans. Welcome to another episode of You, Me, Empathy. This is episode 111. It's a very special episode for a number of reasons. First and foremost, my guest is Jen Pasteloff. She wrote this amazing book called On Being Human, and it's a life-affirming book. It's beautiful. It shares her story of growing up deaf and living as a deaf person, battling with anorexia and beauty seeking and listening with your whole body and empathy. It's such a beautiful book. And so that's exciting thing number one, is that the great Jen Pasteloff, and this was actually recorded in Jen's kitchen in her apartment in Los Angeles. So that was very special, and I felt very lucky to be there and hanging with her. And I drank out of her Rick Astley mug, which was delightful. You hear us talk about that in the episode. It's a great episode. So that's exciting thing number one. Exciting thing number two is that I'm giving away two copies of Jen's book, On Being Human, two signed copies. I'm giving those away today. So check out, go over to the Instas. I don't know why I said that. Ugh, I hate myself. Go over to Instagram at You, Me, Empathy and at Feely Human to look out for that book giveaway. So stay tuned for that. The final and most exciting thing to me, sorry, Jen, you're very exciting to me. Well, you're on par. Okay, you're on par with this. I'll say this. A very exciting thing, number three, all three things being very on par, exciting to me, is today, you guys, is the crowdfunding launch day for the Feely Human Collective. Woo! I am beyond the moon excited. I'm beyond all of the galaxy excited, because this thing that I've been working on, it's a new collaborative mental health platform that will exist in its first phase with workshops, with a journal where you can share your story, a new podcast episode on Fridays, a Feely shop with pins and stickers and t-shirts, and the crowdfunding campaign is to kind of just really grow the first phase, is to get more workshop content and really grow our capacity for empathy and vulnerability and you know, our emotional intelligence, and you know, allow really grow and create a space of safety and giving us a safe space to really feel our feelings. And I'm so excited that the crowdfunding campaign is finally here. It's very exciting. I hope with all of my heart that you can support it financially. If you can't, if you're not in that place now, I totally understand. But there is a way you can help. And by that is sharing the campaign as far and wide as you can. It's very important in this first week to raise money. It's the first week is the most important. So please share far and wide if you want to make the world a more Feely place like I do. The Feely Human Collective is attempting to do that. And if that's part of your heart, please share far and wide. Please support it. And you can go to the crowdfunding campaign right now. Pause this very episode and listen to it later if you want. Go to feelyhumans, that's plural, feelyhumans.co, feelyhumans.co, and that'll redirect to the Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign. Again, so excited. Please support the Feely Human Collective. It's been something I've been working on for a long time and will continue to work on it, because Phases 2 and 3 include in-person workshops in businesses and schools, retreats, like in-person retreats, Feely retreats with you guys. I want to create like empathy toolkits for classrooms and all sorts of lovely things. So please go support it, and let's kick this January 15th, this day off, strong in the Feelyverse, right? Let's do it. We can do it. Again, the URL to go to is feelyhumans, plural, feelyhumans.co, feelyhumans.co, F-E-E-L-Y, humans.co. That'll redirect to the Indiegogo campaign. Thank you so much for all your support. If you have any questions, if you feel like you can't support it financially and you, whatever, just please reach out to me too. Like, I'm open, on Instagram at FeelyHuman. Please follow. Please DM me if you have questions about the campaign, anything. If you just want to like do something special in support of the campaign, like, I don't know, whatever. I'm open to any ideas. I'm really excited to get this out into the world and make this a reality. So thank you. I appreciate you. Okay. That's the pitch. Again, go to FeelyHuman on Instagram, at FeelyHuman, YumiEmpathy on Instagram, at YumiEmpathy, also on Twitter. Make sure to look out for that On Being Human book giveaway. Go to FeelyHumans.co for the crowdfunding campaign. Please, 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 pretty please, with 1 billion cherries on top. Enjoy this episode with the truly stunning and amazing gem of a Feely Human, Jen Pasteloff. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a podcast about exploring the struggles we face in our day-to-day lives as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our mental health, our neuroses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, I'm filled with all the feelings of being human because I'm here with beauty seeker, best-selling author, and vulnerability hero of mine, Jen Pasteloff. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I was just videoing you.
And I saw that. I could sense it.
I know. I saw you. But the funniest thing is, like, I have a bottle of antidepressants on the table that was in the shot, and I just thought that was so on brand.
Perfect. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. So what do you take?
Prozac.
Okay.
So the other day when I was in Ojai again, where I first met you in person, and I on Saturday, I took a hot yoga class with my friend who owns the studio where I met you.
Yeah, Peak Ellen. Power.
Mm-hmm. And I can't wear my hearing aids in hot yoga because they sweat. And so I didn't have anything to put it in. So I put it, I don't know if you saw my post, I put it in my, this
yes,
jar.
Yes.
This antidepressant bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
And the irony, I made a post on it and, you know, I forgot to take them for 2 days. I took a picture of it and everything.
God.
I know, it's fine.
How'd you feel?
I feel fine. It's interesting. Saturday night, I had a lot of trouble sleeping and then it dawned on me the next day. I did eat too much salt and probably,
Sure.
But it was hot, but I was like, oh, I forgot to take my meds, so.
I've been taking an antidepressant for 5-6 years now, and I still forget from time to time.
I'm pretty good at it, but. Yeah. And usually one day doesn't do something with Prozac. I used to be on something years ago called Cymbalta, and I could tell when I missed it. And it, honestly, I preferred that med. It did more for me, but I went off and it was really hard to go off. And Prozac is just gentler, although it, sometimes it feels like it doesn't work anymore. It's probably been 4 years I've been on it.
Okay. So why did you change? Because it's just softer, easier on the body?
No. I changed because two reasons. One, I went off my meds because I thought mistakenly, oh, my life is great now. I'll be okay. And, you know, it just goes to show you, it doesn't matter how, quote unquote, great your life is. If you have a chemical imbalance or you struggle with depression, yes, certain things exacerbate it. But I could have, people were emailing me 10 messages a day, how it changed their life, how amazing I was. Nothing affected me.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought, my life's great. I'll go off the meds. In order to go off them, my doctor suggested I take Prozac to help me wean off the Cymbalta, which I did, and I went really slowly, and it worked brilliantly. And then once I was off, that's when I'm talking about the deadness happened. Like, I'd get these emails, and everything was just flat. I felt nothing and everything at the same time, if that makes sense.
Totally makes sense.
Like, constantly, my eyes were about to cry, and yet I felt dead inside. The other reason I had gone off, beside the fact that I thought, well, my life is great now, is I wasn't 100% sure that I wouldn't have a baby. I didn't think I would, but supposedly you're not supposed to be on Cymbalta.
Right.
So I thought, all right. And anyway, it was a mistake. So it lasted about a year, less than a year. And I had the Prozac in my drawer from when I had weaned off using, and I emailed my doctor and he's like, just start taking that. And I stayed on it. And that's that. And then I got pregnant and I stayed on Prozac. I just lowered it a tiny bit, but I stayed on it the whole time.
And you have a beautiful boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. So the time that I missed, completely missed, and the next day I was feeling, I took something called Vibrid.
Vibrant.
It's not Vibrant.
I could see the commercial in my mind's eye.
No. It's Vibrant. Yeah.
But may cause erectile dysfunction.
Right. And yeah. Thankfully not.
Okay. I got it.
Yes. Thankfully Woo! Not. Woo. Yes. But like the next day, like 12 hours later, I was cranky. There was just this pallor on the world.
Yeah.
This sheen of like darkness.
That's how it was with Cymbalta.
Yeah. And that's something like, so my question to you, like recently I've been like having darker spells, even like going back to like moments of like self-harm and stuff, okay. Like having those thoughts again. So I'm wondering like if I should maybe change. What has been your sort of recent thinking?
So how can I explain it? Cymbalta definitely, stronger is a very, not a very intelligent way to describe it, but that's how I think of Cymbalta for me was like, it just felt like it worked better.
Yeah.
And Cymbalta also, I have a lot of injuries, and Cymbalta is also supposed to help with pain management.
Oh, okay.
So like I have plantar fasciitis, you know, so sometimes I can't even stand. So the Prozac, I don't know, just over time, I don't know if I've just gotten used to it or what have you. But don't get me wrong, I've toy with the idea of going off all the time because, but I won't, not yet anyway, because I miss feeling so much. Like it definitely dulls me a bit.
Yeah.
But there's like no middle ground for me. Do you know?
Yeah.
So
I get that sense about you.
And also it's like a fear thing, switching. I'm like, oh, go through a whole thing again. And
it's exhausting. It's,
yeah. So yeah. I stay and I take good old fashioned Prozac and.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exhausting. Like we've talked a lot about on this podcast about the anxiety that comes with medication, you know, and like changing and what will it do to my body and how will it affect my mood and will I be the same? Like these are
absolutely,
like as universal fears as possible.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I miss the other way, but you know, it's like, it's a choice I have to make and
yeah.
I don't know if it's worth it being that raw, for lack of a better word. I don't know if it's worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I definitely wrote more. even though I was depressed. It's interesting. Depression, anxiety is more debilitating for me. It always has been. Because the anxiety makes me panic. It makes me, repeat myself, jump around. Depression is just flat and sadness. And with writing, sometimes I could still write through that. Anxiety, I can't sit still. I can't.
Yeah. I relate to that. I did a lot of writing unmedicated. My biggest reason for sort of continuing on my antidepressants is Jessica, my wife. Because being off them for me is like such an impact on her. She sees it. She senses it. She feels that like darkness in me.
Of course. Yeah. When you live with someone and you have a family or whatever it is, when I was by myself, when I lived by myself, it's so much easier to be self-abusive or to not come out of not talk for a day or whatever it is.
You don't have that mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. So I was listening to your book again on the way up driving here. The listener should know that I'm sitting in Jen's adorable apartment in Los Angeles. It's very cozy. There's beautiful art on the walls. There's great books. I saw The Body Keeps the Score over there, one of my all-time favorites.
There's Trunky. Trunky is my 3-year-old suitcase with wheels. I pull him on it in the airport, and there's toys inside.
And it has, I don't know if those are horns or ears, but Trunky is adorable as well.
What else is there? There's a bicycle on the ground.
There's a big old Buzz Lightyear over there. There's a big teddy bear. Yeah, it's
toddler snacks everywhere.
It feels loved.
What did you say?
It feels loved.
It is loved.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I feel I have to qualify my house a lot, and I have to really battle with shame sometimes, and I didn't feel that with you.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well,
you're such a feely human.
That's what I am.
I know.
We have a very tiny house. Our house is 700 square feet. The whole house.
But you understand. I'm quote unquote, a public figure. So are you. But I'm like more well known. And I have a national bestselling book and all these things. And so it's like there's part of me that has to really battle the should. Like I shouldn't still be living here. And, it's just.
But you said early on in your book, you said, essentially like I'm a person who doesn't go along with the norms, right? Like
that's
not who I am. And I don't know you very well, but I've read your book and it sort of hit my heart so at the core. And I related to so much of your story. But if I like had come here and you were in this like mansion, it was like, this doesn't seem right,
Well, I mean, the thing is, okay, look, there's a middle ground between a one-bedroom apartment and a mansion. So, no, I would like a two-bedroom apartment. I don't think it's that much to ask. The thing is, it's funny because I was texting with Cheryl Strayed, I don't remember, a couple
name
months
drop.
Ago. I was just about to say that. That's hilarious. I was about to go name drop, but someone had given me, I was upset, and I confided in her because someone had, actually wasn't going to talk about this, but I will. Someone had written something really shitty to me. Now, you're sitting in my apartment. You could clearly hear the soup cooking. You could clearly see how I live, and how much I attempt to do for others and whatnot. But anyway, somebody who had spent a week with me in one of my retreats, so that to me is very intimate, maybe 5 years ago, sent me a message that said something to the effect of, I just can't stomach how you take so much and you have so much. Because quite often when I'm raising funds for people, they can either go right to the link and buy the groceries, or they'll send me the money and I'll do it and, whatever. But I'm constantly raising money and trying to do things. And I got so hooked. I was like, first of all, what am I taking? And then also I have so much, like what? And so I was upset. I'm not anymore, but I'm human. So, and also I was upset because it wasn't a stranger.
Right. Right.
And the irony that I feel like all I do is give, it would be like, look, you could say something to me, it was true. If you said to me, I don't even know, like Jen, you're not generous. I'm like, okay, well that doesn't, you could say, Jen, you're a slop. Yes, that's true. Right. So I reached out to Cheryl and she's like, you know, she's made a lot of money from book sales and she's proud of it. And she said, but people are so, they think just because you wrote a book or just because you lead workshops, you know, people have no idea. So yes, I lead workshops and I do well. I don't have to wait tables anymore, but I don't necessarily do well enough to be able to afford a place where I live right now in Santa Monica, California.
Yeah.
But people make up stories and have ideas. And so, but it's part of the reason why I'm so open about how I live, you know. But every once in a while, there's still that moment of, especially when I travel, like in Ojai this weekend, and I go and I stay with my friends that have big homes, space, a bedroom for their kids. I think, gosh, that would be nice. I should be there.
Yeah. You know, there's so much in life that is thrown at us and people say to us that, you know, most of the time it's really not, you know, they're just going through something, right? It's not about us. It's just a projection that they're feeling shame or they're feeling insecure or whatever, like who knows what they're feeling. But when that happens to me, I try to remind myself that like, okay, in this moment, they're not seeing me for who I am. They're not seeing my heart, right? And in that moment, they didn't see your heart either, right? They weren't seeing the sort of honest reflection that you were giving them, right?
No, and she's still not, and it's fine. Yeah. And I've actually finally just yesterday blocked her. I thought, well, I'm just going to block this person. But I hear you, and my brain hears you. And where I get stuck, and I'm really open about this, is the, like, in the moment, my brain doesn't kick in and go, well, this is not about you. You know, it hurt. And so I let myself feel hurt. And now I'm not anymore, truly.
And it's okay to feel hurt.
Yeah. If I was still sitting in that, then I'd have to look at that and be like, why am I still 2 or 3 months later hooked by some nonsense? But and there's always going to be, I mean, it's the thing I talk about all the time, the one in the 100, there's always going to be that one.
Yeah.
And yeah, it hurts worse when it's someone that you know. That's always like, whoa, that threw me for a loop. I thought you were, you know, a troll on the internet.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's hard. But one of the other things that you say in your book, at some point, I forget how you iterated it, but
I don't understand. You don't have the whole thing memorized?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'm getting there. Yeah, I've been hiring help to like read it aloud to me while I sleep. but like something along the lines of like, we can be this thing and this thing at once. So like the world isn't binary, right? There aren't, we can be this and we can be that, right? And that's an important distinction.
It's like
because
it's like, remember that song in universe... the 90s? That you could get with this or you can get with that.
Sure.
Black Sheep?
I don't know. Okay, anyway. I'm not very musically inclined. But yeah, I mean, and like that for me, like that's how the universe exists. And that's how we exist as humans within that universe, right? We are reflections of
the younger generation understands that a lot better these days.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, yeah.
Because we are holding on to our old stories, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm... and is perhaps my favorite word. You know, it's like, okay, I'm deaf and listening. I'm confident and also really insecure, you know?
Yeah.
And...
Yeah. Yeah. There's too much, I think, in life that wants to just focus on one thing. Mm-hmm. And then that's the thing that we define this person by or this thing by, and there's no space for the other. And I think that's limiting, and it's not reflecting what humanity is, what on being human is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what you start off the book talking about beauty seeking, this thing about seeking beauty in the world, looking for beauty. Can you sort of describe what that means to you?
Mm-hmm. It dawned on me actually this weekend in Ojai. I was texting with, just kidding. I mean, I was texting with someone, but
I was Snapchatting.
I was
with
texting
Oprah.
With Beyonce, and Beyonce said, "Girl,
Queen Bey, Queen Bey, I should say.
What?
Queen Bey.
Queen Bey said, girl." Stop sleepwalking. No, I was texting with a friend and I was saying I feel sometimes like I sleepwalk through life. And that's been a theme of my life. I go through, you know, all the years at the restaurant, I felt like that. I felt like I was like a walking dead person. And sometimes I slip back into that.
Hmm.
Like the day will end, I'll go, where was I? Like, hello.
That's normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like it. And I don't like it when, like, you know, consecutive days happen like that or...
But isn't that just you being human and saying, like, okay, I can't be on all the time?
No, I'm not talking about being on. Okay. I'm not talking about being on. I'm talking about paying attention, noticing beauty, writing things, creating, reading, just sort of... yeah, it's definitely not talking about being on. I guess I just feel like sometimes I am not awake. I mean, I wrote a book called, you know, Waking Up, Living Real, and Listening Hard. And I feel the best. And who I want to be is someone who's awake. Absolutely not talking about being on, but just noticing. I mean, if you want to call that being mindful.
Yeah.
Right? So I said to my friend, Beyonce, I said, Ashley, I said, you know, I feel like I sleepwalk sometimes. Because she said this quote, and I loved it. Her name's Ashley Van Buren. She said, she flung herself at the world, curiosity first. And like my arm hair stood up. I thought, beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to live like that. And sometimes a lot of times I don't. Especially when, and I don't know if you can relate this, it's really easy when I'm working, when I'm traveling, when I'm doing retreats, and then I get home, there's like two of me, right? And then I get home and I'm like, ugh. It doesn't have to be that way. And that's, beauty hunting is the antidote to not paying attention, to not noticing. It's just stopping where you are right now. What's beautiful?
Hmm.
Not of my whole life, not of the year, right now.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it feels like nothing and you have to look harder and deeper. And it's a spiritual practice.
Hmm.
It's just a really great, I've found great way to live my life. And it's inspiring. And it's a great way to create conversation with other people that's not gossipy or shit talking or fault finding.
Yeah.
And it really, really forces you more than anything else I've seen to pay attention. It's like, if you're always just looking for what's beautiful. Wow, this cup of coffee. Wow. You know, and not in a fake way.
Right, right.
Because if it's like a shitty cup of coffee, you don't have to say, wow, that's a beautiful cup of coffee.
This Rick Astley mug is beautiful.
Because, you know, I did a retreat in Italy. It was a year, maybe 2 years ago now. And they behind my back, which is very easy to do because of my hearing loss, they can like plot things and I won't hear.
Yeah.
They plotted a flash mob dance party.
Whoa.
To Never Gonna Give You Up, Rick Astley. So someone from that, a friend of mine knew, and so she gave me this mug that says, things Rick Astley will never do. Give you up, let you down, run around, desert you, make you cry, say goodbye, tell a lie, hurt you, all of the above.
It's perfect.
It's clever.
Yeah. So, like, intellectually, I understand what you're saying about beauty seeking, right? Is paying attention to life. But for me, at times I feel like it's hard. It's hard. I get stuck. I don't want to do it because it feels overwhelming.
Read my
at
lips.
Times.
No shit.
So, and that's, so in a sense, you're saying that's what life should be, is every day paying attention.
Yeah, and I'm saying that's the point.
That is the point.
That's the point, especially for someone who struggles with depression or grief or whatever. That's the point, because otherwise, why get out of bed?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I used to think about this a lot. I live 9 blocks from the beach, right? Which is, dear listeners, why I keep this apartment and this rent-controlled apartment. And I used to do these walks after I waited tables during sunset, and I still am. I'm flabbergasted by people who don't look up at the sun. And this was even before people were in their phones so much. But
yeah.
I'm like, how are you not in utter awe? How are you not dropping to your knees looking at that sky? How are you just like, meh, seen it before?
Right.
But you haven't.
Right.
Yeah, that's always going to be the challenge. Yeah, it's hard and I get stuck and everything. So look deeper. Like right now. Let's just play 5 beautiful things right now. From today, from this morning till right now. Go.
I took a picture of my dog Scooby this morning.
Beautiful.
And his tongue was like out at the right time. I'll show it to you after. It's a beautiful picture. Being here with you is awesome. A beautiful moment. Connecting with a friend. I gave Charlie a little... Wallace action figure, yeah, from Wallace and Gromit,
amazing
British show that I love. Seeing the Body Keeps a Score on your bookshelf.
Great.
A book that I love and got so much out of, and seeing it on your shelf. I love looking at bookshelves in general. You making me coffee. It was a beautiful.
Beautiful. Beautiful now, see, thing. I get emotional at that because it's just simple things. It's not like these like life-altering things. And isn't that life? So mm-hmm. often it's just the mundane, finding the beauty in the mundane. Yeah, but isn't that beautiful?
It is beautiful.
Having someone offering, like, yeah. making you a meal or a cup of coffee or it's showing of love.
Connecting. Yeah, it's love. It's love. Now, as humans, I think we were sort of compelled by media, which tells us, like, we do have to, like, go after those big things. And it's all about the big things, right? How do we ignore that bullshit?
Such a serendipitous, great question, because I was actually just thinking about this morning. I started getting in my head. My inner asshole started, these weird, nobody likes me. I'm failing, bullshit stories.
I am a bad person.
Totally. That's my old school forever mantra that I really battle with. And I started thinking about, one of the hows to not get caught up in that is I have to not look at social media so much.
Yeah, that's a big one.
It's, for me, the biggest one.
Yeah.
It's an addiction for me.
Mm.
It really is. It's so, it's mindless. It's an addiction. It's taking me away from being here. But then I get caught up in, oh, look, that person's book just came out and it's already a New York Times bestseller and this and that. And look at there and they just
playing the comparing games.
Yeah. Going down these rabbit holes of, wow, look what they're doing. They already sold another book. And I'm talking about books, obviously, because that's the world I'm in right now.
Right.
But, okay, Jen, then just stop looking. And I love the connection of it, but look once a day or whatever it is to not get so consumed.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is create. Just keep creating, whatever that looks like, whatever that is, whatever that means. You know, my son and I were drawing, and I always joke, and I go, even if it's a cup of coffee, make something.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah, I like that. I think physiologically we're sort of bred or designed or produced, whatever you believe in, to create. We are creators. Like, that's what I think our minds and brains are meant to do. I agree with that. Yeah, the social media thing, like, it has been a beautiful thing for me in the podcast and has been such a connecting force. And, like, you know, when, like, people, and I'm sure you get this as an author, like someone who's written such a beautiful book that has reached so many millions of people.
Billions of people have read it.
I mean, it's Michelle Obama's favorite book.
I know. Well, yeah. Both of the Obamas.
That's true. Yeah. Both of them. They love it.
I know. I'm glad I put the phone on mute because they were just calling.
I mean, yeah, you're just so popular. But, I get, like, messages from this woman in Australia who says, like, because of your podcast, I've been able to be a better mom to my son. Like that, and that's amazing. And that's is the aim that I want. That's what I want to do with my life. But also, so it's this connecting force, but it's also this depleting force.
Yeah. I mean, well, apparently I don't have the cold, dead heart I thought I did because that made me teary eye. But
but it's just like mindset, right? And, well, it's about creating our boundaries and all that stuff.
It is. And it's also like what you said earlier about the whole, and it's like, of course, everything is like that.
Yeah.
You know, people that bash social media, it's like, oh, you know what? Screw you. That's how I got my hearing aids. That's how I am able to feed these families I help feed and get diapers and get lights turned back on and make all these meet you.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You can't completely bash it. I do my best to use my platform for good, for social change, for inspiration. Yeah, sometimes for bullshit, but it's when it starts to consume you.
Yeah.
Or make you feel bad about yourself or not enough or become toxic.
Yeah.
Anything, right? Anything's like that. Like sharing a beautiful bottle of wine and then, oh, all of a sudden, if you're having 3 bottles of wine a night, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Or if you're an alcoholic, then, but it's anything in moderation, including moderation, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hear that. I'm a wine drinker like you.
You're a what?
I'm a wine drinker as well.
Oh, good. Yeah. Would you like a glass of wine?
Not in this moment, okay. But maybe after.
Okay.
I'll take you up on that. Yeah, I have this underpinning of like, and I think it's good. I think it can serve me, but it also takes away. It's the mindset of like chaos reigns.
Of what chaos?
Chaos reigns.
Race.
Reigns. Exists.
Oh, yes.
The world is chaos.
Yes. I mean, please just take a look around my apartment and let's talk about chaos.
Right. But what I mean by that is I get to a point in my mind sometimes where the chaos becomes like a mechanism for me to even like feel a little like nihilistic at times about meaning in the world.
Yeah.
But you're talking about like finding all this beauty in the world, and that's meaningful. And so I have to challenge myself because I can, as someone who was like raised in a very strict religious home and is not that way anymore, like I have a tendency to like take that too far and say like,
yeah,
nothing means anything, and I'm sort of like this nihilistic punk, right? But I don't want to be that way because that's not a great place to be.
Yeah. And so, it doesn't occur, at least to me, that that's how you're living your life.
I mean,
that may be a response to how you were raised, and you have to battle that sometimes, but Mr. Feely Human isn't exactly like, you know. I have a lot of that same thing, too. I wasn't raised in overly religious, but before my dad died, we were, you know, like uber Jews. Mm-hmm. And I went to yeshiva, and just very, which is like, it was like Hebrew all morning, English in the afternoon, and then my dad died, and that was that. And I thought God hated me because of what happened, and so many confusing beliefs about God. And I envy a lot of time people that have such strong faith.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
In what seems to be nothing, and yet it keeps them going. And I think if we don't have some kind of faith, something, whether it's in beauty or nature or what you call God, it's like, why get out of bed? And when I get really depressed, I do get into that, like, ugh, nothing means anything.
Yeah. I think we do have to have faith, whether it's in a religion or just existing, because there is so much mystery, right?
Yeah.
And I think being able to recognize that we don't know everything and things change and all these things, that's us sort of saying goodbye to our ego and just kind of living as we should be existing, right? You know, sort of going for the ride.
Absolutely. And it's not easy because I think a lot of us are wired to want to control. And so when you start to embrace the idea that, like, I don't know shit, it's it goes against the notion of being in control.
Yeah. So speaking of control, I, like you, have a history of eating disorders.
Oh, really?
Late teens through like mid-20s, I had an anorexic period. And for me, it was very much about control. Like I was feeling out of control in my life. I used food to feel like I had a sense of control. Was that the same for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I didn't initially know, but of course, looking back, it doesn't... I mean, when I first became anorexic, I was 17, and I went to the doctor with my mom because she was having it's funny that I can't remember. It was either a breast reduction or her implants taken out.
Mm.
Either way, I went with her and I said to the doctor, I want to get a breast reduction. And he looked at me and he said, you're not going to get a breast reduction. You're crazy. Lose 5 pounds. What? And I had never, never thought about that or dieted or exercised. I used to play soccer and field hockey, but terribly. But it was never, I ate cheesesteaks and I lived in, you know, cheese fries. I lived in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And
that's the land Philly. Of cheesesteaks.
Right, Philly. So anyway, I lost 5 pounds and then I couldn't stop. And then I kept going, and there was the control thing. And I had been missing it, you know. And as someone who did not want to feel when my dad died and never let herself feel anything, it was the perfect way. And yeah, for 4 years, I didn't get my period. And it was always about control. And it still is. You know, I don't do anything to harm myself. I still have thoughts sometimes,
sure,
but I don't act on it. And it's always about control. When I'm feeling stressed out, that's where my mind goes. It's like a synapse. Oh, if I was just 10 pounds skinnier, if I just was thinner, then I could deal with this, then it would be easier, then I wouldn't, you know, and it's just not true.
Isn't that funny? Like when we feel stressed or out of control, we want to buckle down on the trying to sort of control this thing we really don't maybe
yeah,
have
because
control.
What else can you do?
Yeah, it's just like this jerk reaction.
Yeah. So dangerous. You could, at least when you at least now, you know, hopefully you and I both, we recognize it.
Yeah.
And I go, there it is again, inner asshole. Nope. And just about like rewiring that synapse so that when I feel stressed, my brain doesn't automatically go there.
Yeah. Yeah. I consider myself recovered, right, from anorexia. But I'm still hypersensitive to, like, I was just having a conversation on the podcast with Christy Harrison, mm-hmm. who's she calls herself an anti-diet dietitian.
Okay.
And we were talking about sort of diet culture and like thin privilege and all this stuff that I am keyed into because it's just like, that was my world, right? Like that was the thing. And I feel like I'm so, there's still so much of it that exists, like so much disorder stuff that exists.
People
right.
think mainly it's women, so
right.
It's always, you know, I've met a few men in my, you know, journey, but it's predominantly women, and right. and even when it is men, they don't talk about it.
Right. Yeah, that people bring that up a lot, and I appreciate it. For me, yes, I am a man, genetically, biologically, but I always just like to call myself a human, a feely human at that.
Well, yeah, you're special. I mean, that's, you know.
I'm here for Jen to give me compliments. That's why I drove up. No, but like yes, I think on one hand, it's important to say, yes, I am a man and I'm talking about anorexia and that's important. I'm talking about feelings. That's important. But I also think like the other side of it is important. Like I'm human and this is what brings us together and that's how we're connected. And this is, you know, what, you know, I've had this experience, you've had this experience, and that's a human experience.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. But it's not, for example, people say to me things like all the time, like, why are you so open or how are you this way? Well, I don't know another way to be. So for you, this is just the way I am, Jen. This is how I'm wired and everything. But it's not how our culture, how men present themselves normally.
Right.
And quote unquote accepted, you know, yeah. macho. And more lately, yes, I see men in my workshops and I see men becoming more vulnerable. But it's not, it's still pretty rare.
Mm.
Not
I hope
in your
to change
world,
it.
Maybe.
I yeah, hope to. Not in my world.
No, because you're in a world of like right. like-minded people. So yeah. you're around other dudes that are like, give me a hug, let's cry together.
Yeah.
But like my husband, I've never seen him cry.
Mm. We should do that.
Yeah.
We should make him cry.
Make him cry. You know, it's a lot of it. It's cultural. He's Iranian and British, and
sure.
it's being a man. And there's so many
stiff
things.
Stiff upper lip thing.
Age, yeah.
yeah, yeah.
So, it's unique and it's important. And I hope more men, more humans, get courage from that to go, oh, I can be more human and less what I think man should look like.
Yeah, I hope so too. How long have you been married?
Next month, 10 years.
Great. So Jessica and I, about 10 years as well.
Oh, wow. Hope we make it. Knock
on
wood.
We'll see how the day goes. Yeah. but I'm wondering, like, have you seen a change in him?
Oh, absolutely. How can you not?
How can you not
be married to me and vice versa?
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And yet he's also not, if he came to my workshop, he's come a couple times, you know, into the room. And if you call on him, he gets sort of nervous and subconscious and he'll say something very sort of shallow or not shallow, but on the surface, you know, it's just,
yeah,
it's work. But yes, I have, you know, I think it would be impossible to not have seen a change, but yeah, past life rubs off on you.
It does. So you mentioned earlier that like this is the only way I can be, right? So my journey, like I grew up in, I mentioned the religious environment and like, violent father, and sort of I learned to sort of shut down and like guard my heart, right? I'm what, yeah, like was that similar?
Because that
like,
was exactly my
right now,
exactly.
Like the empathy, vulnerability, like sharing my feelings is like this is my salvation.
So my dad was my world, and it was like, you know, it was me and daddy and my sister and my mom, and that's just how it was always. And then he died. Before he died, he had asked me to go across the street and get him a pack of cigarettes. This was the 80s. Isn't that hilarious? You could send your 8-year-old to do that. And I said,
better times.
Right?
The good old
hard
times.
Pack of cools. And he said, I said, you promised you'd stop smoking. You always break your promises. I hate you. And he said, you're being bad and making me not feel good. And I said, I hate you. And that was the last thing I ever said to him. Mm. So I take in, you're being bad. They came in, told me he died. I said, I don't care. And I locked my jaw, and that was that. And yeah. No matter what, my mantra always was, do not feel, do not feel, do not feel. And I struggle with it now. When something happens, I feel this weird thing come up that like goes, do not feel. Mm. So,
because as a kid, you were so afraid to feel all the emotions of losing your dad.
I suppose. I mean, it felt like a physiological response that had I have no idea why. But looking back, I suppose I thought I think there's two reasons. One, if it was like, it'd be a flood, you know, and I wouldn't be able to shut it off. But the second one is, God bless my parents, but they treated me like an adult, like their best friend, both of them. Mm. And so I decided, and this breaks my heart to think of now, but I thought, I have to be an adult. I cannot show emotion. I have to be strong. And that makes me sad. You know, like, why the hell did I think I couldn't be a little kid and be sad?
It's sad.
So.
Yeah, that's hard.
Everything's about protection. I think, you know, the whole clenching thing to me, which I still do, I still struggle with clenching my jaw and grinding. It's like such a metaphor for, I just shut it down, locked it in. So when I found anorexia and over exercising, anything to just keep going with the not feeling, not going to feel.
It's like a perfect avenue.
Nope. Yep, yeah. Not going to feel.
Yeah. Did you ever do any self-harming or just the thoughts?
In the sense, that I would take, I didn't do any cutting, if that's what you mean, no.
But the over-exercising, the eating disorder is
I would exercise
for sure.
4 hours a day. And if I didn't do that much, then I would consider I didn't exercise. So if you would say, did you work out? And I did for an hour, I'd say no. And I would not think I was lying. I used to abuse laxatives. I would like bleed. I would be on the toilet begging God, God, please, if you let me get through this night, I'll never do it again. Mm. Next night, doing it again. I took this thing called super dieters tea. I would take 5 of them and put them in the littlest amount of water. And I mean, I don't know how I didn't die.
Wow.
I never was bulimic. I could never get into that. But the laxative thing, I mean, I'm surprised my body works. The laxative thing was such a problem. So yes. And the starvation and the overexercise.
Yeah. There's been a ton of research on people who've had eating disorders and its impact on intestinal issues, diseases and stuff. Do you have any like...
Oh God, I know I have terrible digestion. I'm always bloated. My husband's like, stop farting.
I'm the same way. I'm a fart machine.
Oh my God, seriously. What's really funny, and this will be very telling of our relationship. So my husband is Iranian and British. So he's got both of those sort of formal. Before him, I would die before I'd fart in front of a guy. Die. Now, maybe like 15 times a day. And my son, too. And my husband has never farted in front of me.
Amazing.
Never.
Wow.
I know. And
that's another thing we're going to make him do. Fart.
Oh, my
in
God.
Front
fart
of
and
us.
Cry.
Fart and cry.
He's going to kill me when
same
he hears
time.
This. He's going to kill me. You know, but my digestion is terrible. I have like, you know, my mom has this intestinal stuff. She had to have surgery. I think some of it's hereditary. Some of it. You know, trauma is inherited.
Yeah.
Too. So, yes, my intestinal life is not so great.
Yeah.
It doesn't help all the coffee I drank. You know, I'm classic, like, oh, this isn't good for me. Let me take some more. But
you, like, that's one of the things, one of the many things that I admire about you, Jen, is like you, as they say, grok the fullness in life. That's what you seek to achieve.
What is it?
Grok the fullness. You seek to experience life in its entirety, right? And it's all of its wonder and beauty.
I want to.
Well, at least that's the book you wrote, and that's what you put out there online, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really like, and it's in my 40s. I'm like, wow, you know, I want to talk to all the people and experience the food, and I don't want to ever put myself in a prison again like that, where of any kind of denial what's the word when you're like restriction?
Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about like obviously if I'm allergic to something.
Sure.
But like, I can't imagine ever going to Italy again and being like, no, I'm not going to eat pasta. And look, yes, I know some people have celiac and can't have gluten and whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about this, like, I don't deserve it. I'm being quote unquote bad.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
That's a broken way to think.
I also want to be there for it all. Like, so when people say to me, how do you sit with so much grief and this pain people share with you? And I do. And I embrace all of it. That doesn't mean I could do it 24 hours a day.
No.
That doesn't mean sometimes I don't sleep for 10 hours, but...
Right.
I'm here for it, as the kids say.
So, you are deaf.
Yeah, that's why it's funny, because you have the mic up, so I have to keep, like, moving.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
And one of the things about empathy is, like, a huge part of empathy is active listening, right?
Yeah.
And you've done like such an amazing, beautiful job in your workshops, in the work you do.
I'm so glad you came. You got to experience it before this interview.
Me too. Is like listening. Is like listening. And you put it like listening with your whole body.
Yeah. Well, I have to. Like even now. So I have my hearing aids in. If I took them out, it would be a nightmare. But I have to like lean in. I have to work really hard. I have to concentrate. I have to like make sure I can see your lips. I mean,
I witness it firsthand.
Be lazy.
Right. Well, and the thing I love about it, you know immediately that you are there.
Yes.
That you are present.
Yes.
That you are listening with all of your body and you care. And that's like, I think that's such a, it's obviously such a beautiful part of empathy, but it's like a beautiful part of like, that's just how you have to do it. And it's become like this great mechanism for connection.
Isn't it cool?
and really like seeing the whole person, which I just love.
Well, and someone said that to me this morning. What did she say? Like your disability has turned into your greatest, it wasn't ability, but greatest, and it wasn't gift, but something along the lines of it's been such a conduit for me. And it came out of survival. You know, people say, how did you learn how to read lips? And I realized I learned in the restaurant. Waiting tables. And granted, my hearing loss was not as profound 10 years ago, but it was survival. I had to lean in. I had to figure out. I had to squat down. I had to do what I can do. And all this ways I had to listen with my whole body taught me to become such a good listener. And I actually think we all could do better listening that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd imagine that part of your person allows you to even better beauty seek, right?
Yeah, and I'll be honest, sometimes I'm tired a lot. I'm not a tired person, but
aforementioned, you're in your 40s.
Wait, what?
I said, as you said before, you're in your 40s.
Yeah. But okay, I've been a tired person since birth. I swear to God, I don't think a day has gone by since I've been a newborn where I haven't taken a nap, and like a 2-hour nap. It's just like my personality.
That's so amazing.
Not every day, but sometimes I get tired and I don't want to listen, and so I check out. So if it's like a group dinner or something, I'm like, you might see me on my phone, or I like seem like I'm spaced out. It's because it's so fucking exhausting. And it's especially in situations like that. I just can't.
Yeah.
Or if there's like a TV on and there aren't subtitles or something, I'm like, forget it. I don't want to work that hard.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's one of the reasons I'm tired all the time, because I work so hard to hear. It's exhausting.
It makes sense. just like if, you know, let's say I did one of your workshops, something like that. So I did like this mini empathy workshop for Project Heal like a few months back.
Oh, cool.
And like I couldn't imagine doing that, being also deaf and having to like work that hard. So like I know for me, at like in doing the show, I've had to create like boundaries, and because taking it all on like I do and like you do, it's a lot. So how do you like, how do you create boundaries? Like what are the things that you do to like protect yourself?
Well, a couple things to say about that. And this just dawned on me when I want to say it before I forget it, but you know, because I'm so hard of hearing, I have to, like I say, I squat on my butt and like scoot over and pretty much sit on your lap. If I wasn't hard of hearing, that would be a little weird, or it would be, it just wouldn't make as much sense. I don't know. And
yeah,
so it's
you
like,
have a free pass to just get
exactly,
in right in people's faces. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you, deaf ears. So it's because of that, I'm able to get him really close, where if someone else did that, people might be like, ew, I don't know.
Sure.
But it would just, it wouldn't be the same. For me, I have to do that. So another thing is people say to me, oh, you should do a workshop here and here. And if you could do like this many a month, you'd make so much money. Girl, no, it's so, I love what I do. And I think that was apparent to you, but a boundary I would set is like, I couldn't do more than one a month. And in fact, I wouldn't even want to do one a month. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm excited that now I have a speaking agent, because speaking in front of a group is way different than the interaction of my workshop. And then the other boundary, so one boundary is like, yeah, saying no to more gigs and not over booking myself because I'm in fear mode of, I don't, scarcity mentality.
Sure.
And then the other thing is I've gotten better at saying no. At, you know, I can't take on every single person who asked me to help fundraise for them as much as I wish I could. I can't answer everyone's email, and I can't say yes to, I've just gotten better at that. I'm still not great, but I've gotten better at it.
I think it's hardest to get to that place where we are creating those boundaries when you're very empathetic. Like I'm a type, you know, Enneagram at all? Type
no,
2?
No, but people keep talking to me about them.
Anyways, where you want to help people. Your natural inclination is to help. And
I must be the same as you.
And is to give really all of yourself to people before you give to yourself. Like that's my sort of default status that I have to challenge all the time. So it's especially hard for that type of person, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Who I admire so much in this topic is Elizabeth Gilbert. She's so incredible. And if you follow her online, you could see, but at these boundaries, but they're loving, you know, and she said, you know, it took years. I mean, she's been in the public eye a lot longer, but years. You know, part of it is still too, is like, I want people to like me.
Yeah, sure.
Whoever. It's just, it's hard. You think you say no to someone or you can't do something and you think they're going to hate me now and I can't deal with that.
Or it's the person who gives us grief online, right? And like, they can't see me. No, like, but they just don't understand. I got to make them understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, after that woman sent me the thing about like, I can't stomach how much you take from others and you have so much. And like the next day I did a post on my apartment and I thought later like, you know, I didn't need to do that. That's annoying. I don't mind sharing my apartment, but that was a total proof. Like, don't you see? Hmm. How, what do you think you know me and you don't? And I don't owe myself to anyone to explain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
No. To really be like, I'm not going to defend. I'm not going to explain.
You don't need to.
Mm-mm.
No. I mean, there's so much in our actions that speaks volumes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
going back to your sort of younger self when you were clenching your jaw and you were shutting down after your father died, how are you? Because there's a lot of, we hold on to our traumas, right? We hold on to our old stories. How are you like maybe translating some of that experience into your life as a mom?
Great question. Well, I mean, I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but I'm really, really affectionate with my son and really constantly, you know, talking to him about feelings and how he feels. And
that's nice.
Just trying to just stay as open and communicative as possible. And I feel like the work that I do now on the world is a rebuttal to that, my whole life, really.
Yeah.
Of that way of living. And so everything I do now, I try and sometimes fail to be in my body, to be here, to not shut down. And so, you know, he's three, so it's I don't know if it's, it would probably be easier to answer if he was older or a teenager, but sure. I think by encouraging him to feel his feelings and...
to create a safe space.
Yeah.
Safety, I think. Like, that's why I do this show. Like, I didn't feel safe a lot of times as a kid. And I think when we don't feel safe, we don't... like, that's it. That we don't... we can't feel our feelings. Like, we don't...
those are my favorite words. I mean, my favorite words are, it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
Because I did not feel safe.
Yeah.
Once my dad died and I was like, well, that's it. I never felt safe again. And it's my fantasy. Even as an 8-year-old, if you were like, what's your fantasy? My fantasy was that someone would just lean in and go, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And so one of my goals in life is to make people feel safe, to help people feel safe. And that's what my workshop is about.
Absolutely.
That and listening. And I was like, other than that, I can't tell you. I don't know.
But it has to start in that safe space. Like, we have to... yeah. I think that is the aim of being a human, is to create safe spaces for our communities, right? Is to give people an opportunity to show up and to feel their feels and to, you know, meet each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love little kids, and that's why I look back on my... and Charlie's so cute. I look back on my childhood and...
he really wanted to be on the podcast.
I know. Like, we should maybe, like, if he comes back, you know, maybe record something and get him in there. Like, I do look back on my childhood and certainly it wasn't all bad, but, like, I feel... it takes a lot to not feel, like, super sad and just, like, hang on to that sadness, right? Or feel like there's a loss, right? Like, a lost childhood, you know, but
there was.
How do you like process that? Like, how have you, like, through your own work, like, have gone, because we have to look back, right?
Absolutely. I'm gonna have Charlie come back so he can be on the show. You know, I struggle with that. And so I heard something years ago that I loved. I was teaching yoga for this group. They were on retreat. They were widows or people who had lost their partner in military or battle or war. And they hired me to do just a yoga class, an hour yoga class. They were doing a retreat in California. They were from all over the country. And I went... and I did it, and I was packing up my stuff, and I said to one of the women, what are you going to do the rest of the day? And she went, I don't know, probably cry. Just kidding. But not really. She said, I believe in taking 5 minutes of sorrow a day. And the part of me who always felt sad, and the part of me who was always made wrong for feeling sad, you should smile more, and whatever it was that people would say to me, I thought, oh, okay, she didn't say I believe in having a lifetime of sorrow, or I don't believe in, like, not ever getting out of bed. She said 5 minutes of sorrow a day. So, yeah, I feel sorry for myself a lot, and it's a place I get stuck. Like, oh, I was so ripped off. Oh, that is a lost childhood. And so I let myself have those 5 minutes. And by 5 minutes, look, it could be 5 hours, it could be whatever, five days. But really just, okay, yeah, that sucks, and that hurts, and there's that and again. And now... it's one of the reasons I dork it out and I do silly things and I try to be more childlike, because I don't feel like I ever let myself be a child. So I, like, act really silly and I do things that make me feel like a kid.
Yeah. I relate to that a lot. And I imagine having Charlie, like, helps facilitate that. Like, it's an easy avenue to be like...
I'm so grateful.
That's the best, yeah.
He has taught me joy, and also the childlike wonder. And I'm like, wow, I would have missed this. My life would have been great. I'm not saying that, you know, your life isn't complete if you don't have a kid or anything like that. I'm talking about my own personal.
Of course. Yeah.
Persona, personality, heart,
right.
trauma.
Right.
For me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Yeah.
But I won't deny that the yes, there was a loss of childhood. Yes, there was this and that. And those are the facts, and allow myself to grieve and then get up and do something.
Yeah.
Just as I think the problem occurs when we get stuck in that feeling sorry for ourselves or the sadness or the rehashing.
Well, we think it needs to be an integral part of our identities. Like that, and that's what I've gotten stuck on sometimes is like, this is who I am. This is like, this trauma is mine and me. And yes, it is in a way, but it doesn't have to like fully define me.
Yeah, just like depression or my hearing loss or whatever. So yeah, I'm really open about it, but it's also like not just who I am.
Right.
People used to say to me all the time, especially when I was just starting doing this and I was just teaching yoga, why don't you work with, women with eating disorders? And I'm not interested. I am interested in the fact that they want to come to my stuff, but I'm not interested in going just to like a facility and doing that. And that's my personal thing for the, I don't want to be that to become my whole thing.
Yeah.
And also for me, it would be, I think, too triggering.
Sure.
But I remember like, I don't want to become just one thing. That would be my whole identity. It used to be.
Mm-hmm.
When I was anorexic, I wasn't in denial. I knew I was. I wasn't an idiot. I didn't want to let go of it because that was my whole identity.
Right. Yeah.
And then I didn't want to become I'm going to be the person who now, you know, works with people with eating disorders. Like, I can't let that be my whole thing.
Yeah. How did you get out of the eating disorder?
So I realized how much I lie to myself. It's so interesting. Even still, it's kind of scary. But I dropped out of school by accident, by college. I was going to take just a semester off. I had 1 year left. And I got a job in West Hollywood for the summer. And that lasted almost 14 years. And I never went back. Now, I was like really skinny and, you know, like looked like this pen and I looked like I was dying. And then, you know, a month or two into the summer job and all this, I started to gain a little weight. I was still skinny, but I wasn't deathly ill looking. And I started getting all this attention. And in my head, I was like, I'm cured, which is bullshit. And I never really did anything to heal.
Mm.
And it was still constantly gain 20, lose 20, gain 20, lose 20. And also, people are so mistaken if they think, just because someone's not stick skinny, they're not struggling with an eating disorder. It's just like,
yeah,
you know, nonsensical. Yeah. So the truth is, it wasn't until I started doing these workshops and working with people would come up to me, you know, and ask me, how did you heal? And or how do I get better? And I thought, I can't be, you know, saying things to people or teaching people how to love themselves more or at least a little bit and then go home and, you know, be abusing laxatives or still trying to starve myself or hate myself or feel like I'm not enough. So it began to make me want to be more congruent and it began to hold me accountable. And that's why I always say, may I have the courage to be who I say I am, because it wasn't until that, like being with other people, I'm a teacher. Okay, I'm a teacher, and if I say I'm working through this, and I damn well better be trying. So it began, and it just began to, an antidepressant. Who am I kidding? It wasn't until huge. I went on the meds, and it was like 2008, and all of a sudden, I realized maybe 2 days had passed, and I hadn't thought about it, and that I had not had that happen since I was 17 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like 35, maybe? I don't know. So... 33. Yeah, antidepressants. They saved my life. I mean, I made the choice to take them, so that saved my life, but they really... I wish I had gone on them when I was 21.
Yeah, me too. I know. Yeah.
Hindsight.
I know. It's very important. Yeah. I lost what I was going to say. I lost it. It just kind of slipped away.
That happens.
You were talking about...
You asked me how I healed, really.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this wasn't what I was going to say, but I'll just offer it up. For me, it took like the recognition that, I remember what I was going to say, but I'll keep this. The recognition that I didn't really want to die, even though I thought about it a lot. Like really anorexia or eating disorder it's an exercise in slowly dying.
Absolutely. Disappearing.
Yeah. And I almost died. The doctor said my heart would stop unless I did something. And so like, that was like not easy, but it was an opportunity to say, okay, I think I want to live. Let's give this a shot. And it took a long time. Right. What I was going to say before is, so one of the things that I wrote down in your workshop,
are you talking about, I'm going to say that I don't have to be in pain?
I don't need to be in pain.
You don't even understand how much I carried that with me. I've told to my sister.
Oh, that's nice.
It struck me so hard. Yeah.
And I struggle with that. It's I'm trying to make that a part of my mantra for this year and for eternity, right? Is because I hold on to this idea that I had this, you know, rough childhood or whatever. I've had these traumas or whatever. Not whatever, but like, and that's the thing I'm holding on to. Like, these are the pains, and I've grown so accustomed to being in pain, right? That's what I need to be. Like, that's the story that I tell myself. That's the part of my identity that I hold on to and find solace in. And right. it's just the old story.
And it's a lie.
You know? A lie.
And it's also so boring. I think about... I remember I said this in the workshop. I don't know if you remember, but I said something like, I'm so much more attractive now than I was 20 years ago. And it has nothing to do with what I look like,
yeah,
my body. It's that I don't hate myself as much. But it's so much more interesting to be around someone who doesn't hate themselves or who doesn't think that they have to be in pain all the time. And I think about that. I think about, who do I want to be around? And it's so... I'm drawn to someone who takes care of themselves or thinks they're worth it or loves themselves. And so are you. I know it.
Yeah.
We all really are.
Totally.
I think about that all the time. It's just, you know, I think about like when people take themselves too seriously, which is why a sense of humor is at the top of my list for everything. And you too, I can tell. It's just so boring.
Yeah.
And when I think back, I find these journals and all I wrote in them, I didn't take notes about life or things I saw. Or it was just like, I'm so fat. I need to lose 20 pounds over and over and over. And I think, God, what a boring existence. Years upon years of this.
Mm.
Upon years.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I took myself too seriously. I just wrote like stories and novellas about like just straight up like versions of me like murdering people. That's
well, I wouldn't
gross.
Say that's boring. I mean, that's crazy.
It's crazy. It's not great. I mean, it's just a reflection of like where I was psychically, right? You know, it's just...
But it's boring. The idea that we, you know, aren't worth anything, that we're a piece of shit, that we always need to be in pain, it's boring. And that also makes me laugh when I say it like that. I'm like, don't be an asshole. That's boring.
It is hilarious. Yeah. Well, it's why... So... Talking about like your recovery and your getting out of it, like we can't do it alone, right? Like we truly need that the community. We need our communities. We need friendships. We need connections because they are the mirrors back to us. Mm-hmm. They are reflect because we're going to keep telling ourselves lies, like no matter what. As much as we get better at it, maybe it will reduce.
And that's why I was saying the thing about living by yourself. That's why if you're prone, like you and I are, to self-harm or whatever, it's so dangerous. There's no one there to, you know, that's why me with on the toilet with all those laxatives when I was living by myself, you know, had I kept on, had I not left NYU, I would have died.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why what you're doing, Jen, is so life-affirming and like such a reflection of what we are trying to live as humans. Is like you're creating these communities of people who are reflections back to each other. And that's such like, it's my aim. It's like what we need to do.
Yeah. I think that's why I have my tattoo says I got you. That's why I do what I do. I do think that it's everything, everything, community and connection.
We get so much from each other.
I know.
Right? I've learned so much from my guests. I've learned so much from reading your book and connecting with you. Like it's arrogant to think that we can go it alone.
I know.
And that's what, you know, American culture says, where you have to be these rugged individualists, right? But the truth is like maybe and, right? We can be individualist and we need each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a beautiful way to put it. I mean, you didn't get here in a vacuum. Nobody did it on their own, even if you think you did. And yes, you know, there are things we have to do on our own, but asking for help and allowing yourself to be supported and also just looking around, even if you think you haven't been helped, you look around at people who paved the way.
Oh my gosh.
Or people who taught, teachers.
So many. Yeah.
Somebody birthed you, whoever you are, whether you hate your mom or talk to her or best friends or somebody birthed you, you know?
Yeah. So we're in 2020 now, which is a new year, early in 2020. It's January. What are your goals for this
year?
Well,
let's see. I do want to write another book, and I been thinking a lot about that, and my publisher wants another one, so I got to get cracking on that. And I think, you know, I really want to write a book about Should as an Asshole. I don't think that'll be the title. I don't know. But about living my life on my own terms, living your life on your own terms, caring less what people think. I'm doing speaking gigs. I got a speaking agent. So that's really, really exciting. I'm going to be on the cover of Yoga Journal with Elizabeth Gilbert.
For amazing.
I know.
I saw those behind the scene pictures.
It's insane.
And stuff.
I mean, it's just crazy. For the creativity issue. And what else? The next 5 weekends, I'm gone. You know, Seattle workshop, Detroit, New York City, Tampa, and brings us to February. Three retreats to Europe in 2020. A lot.
That's a lot. Do you feel like it's too much?
Sometimes, but I have book workshops. I'm kind of done. So people are like, can you come here and here? And no. Having said that, I'll take more speaking gigs because they pay well. And I do want to get another bedroom, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But I take breaks, you know what I mean? Like, so tomorrow to Friday, I have to teach 2 yoga classes. That's 2 hours, you know? So it's not like every single day. I mean, every single day I'm working because I'm running a business and even social media is work.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm really, you know, one of my words is money for this year. I'm ready. I'm ready to have more space. There,
awesome.
I said it.
I love it.
Yeah, I don't need a mansion, but I'm ready to have more space. I'm ready to write another book, and I need to figure out childcare, and you know, I have a 3-year-old. Like, so this morning, I have 3 books to blurb this week that are due in, like, 2 days. And I was trying to read, and Charlie wanted to play, and he wanted, you know, and it's really hard unless I have someone to watch him when my husband isn't here. And so figuring all that out, but... And I have all this equipment I've had for about a year to start my own podcast with my best friend, and that hasn't happened. I have a lot of big dreams for this year, but my big words are creativity, connection, curiosity, money.
The 3 C's and an M.
And being of service. Just, I want to take that to the next level.
Love it.
Keep on doing that.
Yeah.
You know, more so Elizabeth and I are doing another one of our workshops for free, and I want to be able to do, I'm doing something in New York in January 25th. So listeners, you'll be able to go if you want to join me in New York City, January 25th. It's a yoga class, but you don't have to be a yogi. You don't even have to like yoga. And it's a fundraiser for Christy Turlington's Every Mother Counts. And I'm doing that for free. I want to do more. I'm going to make more money so that I can do more free stuff and do more charitable stuff.
I love
stuff.
It. Yeah. That's great. You're going to have an amazing year.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah.
Human. Thanks, human.
You're welcome, human.
Hello.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm ready. I'm ready for a great year. I had a couple weeks off, a couple weeks of downtime, and now I'm, you know.
Well, I mean, the your year that you just described to me sounds overwhelming to me.
It does too when I said it.
My I hope it translates.
I need a Xanax.
Well, I hope it does translate to a lot more money and notoriety because you deserve it.
Thank you. You know, the thing is, I really do love what I do. I do. And so it energizes me. As long as I pace myself, as long as I take breaks, as long as I'm kind to myself in the downtime, as long as I, you know, just as much as I can balance it out.
Yeah.
So
for me, I always say, like, as much as, because doing this podcast and trying to grow a Feely Human Collective and stuff, it gets overwhelming, right? Like anything. But I say I'm holding on to my why. And
my why.
And my why is serving more people. The why is making the world a more feely place. The why is putting out more empathy in the world. And that, like, that is, I mean, I'm so passionate about it. So it's like, it's easier, right? In a way.
Yeah. And I guess as long as we're, you know, I can't remember if I got to do this in my workshop with you or not, or we might have ran out of time, but I usually ask, what does radical self-care or self-compassion mean to you?
Yeah, you didn't ask
okay.
that.
And people start writing, you know, loving myself more, whatever they write. And then I say, okay, pause, and they look up, and I say, now I want you to give me something specific and tangible and actionable that you're going to do within 24 hours.
And go, maybe you did, and I'm terrible at self-care, and so I've immediately forgotten it.
That's so interesting, because I was like, we did do that.
I think we did,
But it's this tangible thing, and so people get really confused, and it's, oh my God. So I joke, and I say, maybe it's pooping without your three-year-old at your feet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe it's, you know, reading for 20 minutes tonight a book that you want to read, not work, not, you know, not the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's, I've taken to sleeping with my cell phone outside, not next to my head in the bedroom every night. I no longer, because it's just this, it's like first thing I look at when I wake up. It's, you know, the middle of the night. If I can't sleep, I'll look at it and then I'll stay awake. So it's just picking these, as long as you're doing these things every day, they don't have to be huge.
Yeah.
But it's something.
Yeah.
Something that says I'm worth it. Something that says I don't have to be in pain every day. Hello, Charlie.
Oh my gosh, it's Charlie.
Charlie, can you come here for a second?
Hey, buddy.
Charlie.
It's being shy.
We'd like...
Oh, no, it's fine. We asked. We asked for him to be here.
Charlie, I'd like you to tell him about your Paw Patrol. You asked mommy to come to work.
Oh, my goodness. Is Paw Patrol about a bunch of cats?
Yes, Paw Patrol is cats.
Cats? Is it cats or giraffes?
Who's your favorite Paw Patrol? Okay, let's sing a song. Happy birthday. Okay, go.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear mommy. Happy birthday to you. Okay, can you tell him what you got for Christmas? Tell him about that.
Speak up. I can't hear.
Louder. Talk regular. No, you gotta talk regular like mommy is.
Paw Patrol Lookout Tower.
Paw Patrol Lookout Tower?
What is that? Tell him. No, come and talk in the mic. What is it?
It's a thing that you play with.
Something you play with. Okay.
Do you have toys? Yeah. And where are you going tomorrow? Do you go to school?
Yeah.
Oh, there's his voice.
There you go.
I thought he didn't have a voice. How old are you?
3.
You're 17.
No, you're
17.
No, 3.
But you act like you're 17, don't you?
No.
Yes, you do.
No.
Okay. No.
No.
Where did you go this weekend? Did you play with the girls?
No.
Yes, you did. Mm. Were you in Ojai?
Yeah.
What about your other words, you know? Just type yes or no. No, okay. That's enough. You did good. Thank you.
Good job, Charlie. He has a future in podcasting, everyone. Podcasting about dogs.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he, it's so funny because he's not shy at all. So it's interesting when that happens. It's really cute. Very Charlie, cute. Are you shy? Anyway.
Well, we can start wrapping up. We always sort of wrap up the show talking about empathy heroes.
Okay.
So someone in our lives, either we know personally, it could even be like a character from a book or something. So I'm going to go first to give you a moment to think on your empathy hero. And my empathy hero is you. So, you know, when I read your book, I was so struck by, well, first of all, just how beautiful the writing was. I related to it so much, so much of your sort of history and your experience, you know, with your eating disorder. And that's what books and stories should do, is it like all of my favorite stories are like the ones like Where the Red Fern Grows, right? Like,
oh my God.
A kid, I mean, terribly sad, but.
I cried so hard. I love that book.
I love it
too. I don't remember it at all. I just remember I read it in fourth grade and I wept like.
Right. But like, I so related to that kid because he was off alone and I was off alone a lot as a kid and he was with his dogs and I love dogs. And like, that's what like reading that book like makes me feel about your book. It's the same way. It's like, I connected to it. I immediately see who you are and I love that you are real and you put yourself out there and it's just so inspiring and you create such a space that is so deeply empathetic and I love it. So you're my empathy hero. Yeah, take that.
I'm just trying to think, yeah, because it's I think I surround myself with so many people like that, so it's hard to pick one person. But Lydia Yuknovich, she is my partner in the Writing and the Body workshop. She wrote the foreword in my book. The way she lives her life, who she is, for sure. She's one of my heroes. Elizabeth Gilbert. Also, I just saw Liz posted, she's about to go on tour to Australia for 5 cities. On a speaking tour, and she's posted, I'm not going to take a dime from you, Australia. I'm donating every single thing. And this was a big, big money-making gig, and she's donating it all back. And behind the scenes, you know, she does so much that she doesn't post about that I personally know because with my friend Simone, who goes by Black Fairy Godmother, so I could see,
yeah,
it blows my mind. And it's this level of empathy and compassion that has nothing to do with like, oh, look at me. My friend Simone Gordon, the Black Fairy Godmother, I mean, she used to be homeless. She has a nonverbal autistic teenager and she also changes diaper and works at Applebee's and trying to go to school and has 7 people living in her house and
wow. Yeah.
Very poor. And all she does is try to help other people, like people that reach out that don't have food or diapers or medical stuff. And she's like a real life angel.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. 3 amazing examples. Yeah. I love it.
My nephew, Blaze, he has Prader-Willi syndrome and autism, and he is a feeling human. And he's autistic, so it's interesting because, so he's not, you know, like, it's not like he can't make eye contact or can't be affectionate, but it's all on his terms.
Sure.
You know? So he'll do it and then he'll walk away.
Yeah.
He'll be like, enough! Go away! Go away! But his level of empathy is astounding.
I love it.
For animals and humans.
My kind of person.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Where can people connect with you, you know, order your books, all that stuff?
You can order my book anywhere books are sold. It's called On Being Human. And my name is Jennifer Pasteloff. You can find me on my website, jenniferpasteloff.com. Mostly Instagram, Jen Pasteloff. But throw a rock and you'll find me. I'm everywhere on the internet.
Well, awesome. Thank you for being a part
of this. Thank you.
And to you listeners, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring pale blue dot. We have each other. It's Yumi Empathy.